The North Carolina Reading Service presents this program for our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners. And that issue is the Indie Week, Your Independent. The broadcast date and the publication is October the 3rd of 2024. And I'm your reader, John Feddersen, today. And it's a busy issue, it looks like, and so I'll get busy reading it. Here we go. Chief among our articles, of course, the devastation in Western North Carolina that is hard for me even to read about now. And we've all heard descriptions and some of us seen photos and videos. It's incredible. And here's the first article. Hurricane relief efforts move forward in the Triangle. Michelle Schaefer-Old says parts of I-40 are out. They're not letting folks through. We had to get special permission to come in, so we'll become a point where we will have to be escorted in. And Schaefer-Old is CEO of the Diaper Bank of North Carolina, and speaking from the passenger seat of a truck bound for Western North Carolina, where that nonprofit will distribute supplies in the aftermath of Helene. Earlier today, they received permission to take two donation trucks into the region. More will follow in the coming days. Thus far, only food and designated essential supplies have been let in. The Diaper Bank has delivered supplies into several state disaster zones since Schaefer-Old founded it back in 2013 in Durham, including efforts following Hurricane Florence and a tornado in Greensboro, both in 2018. Diapers are often overlooked in times of crisis, she stresses. Even under normal circumstances, WIC and food stamps do not cover sanitary supplies like diapers and period products. Schaefer-Old says nearly half the population that has small children cannot afford that most essential item every single month. When you're pushed into a natural disaster, vulnerable families suffer even more. A lot of times they'll take their last few dollars and get gas to get to the nearest shelter. And then a reprise of the Helene and the devastation around. On Monday, FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agencies, announced it had deployed 200 ambulances and 10 federal search and rescue teams to the affected area. As of Monday night, progress had been made, but hundreds of roads remained closed. 400,000 residents still without power. That was of Monday. That's getting better now. Biden is expected to travel to that region yesterday, Wednesday, and Congress are likely to pass special disaster relief funding. Shelter operators that the diaper service has been able to make contact with describe the situation as dire. On this trip, the Diaper Bank delivers nearly 80,000 baby diapers, 5,000 adult incontinence supplies, 7,000 period products, 55,000 baby wipes, and 2,500 containers of formula. Back in Hillsboro, where that bank is based, Schaefer-Old says the nonprofit is sharing its supply staging space with Day One Relief. That's another local rapid response group in the area. By the way, folks, I'll be listing a large, coming up in this article, there's a large local drop-off points and things of that nature. You can find many, many more on the Internet if you're able to access these links. I can't give you every link. I can give you addresses or at least name. And if you want to re-listen to this, it's put up as a podcast after the broadcast, which happens on Friday. All right, so the first stop is the Black Mountain Fire Station. Afterwards, they go to a clinic in Asheville, caring for several premature babies, then a drop at Cherokee Indian Reservations and drops in Mitchell and Yancey County. It's a careful effort, Schaefer Old stresses individuals should not load up a car and attempt to help before coordinating ahead of time with officials on the ground. For one, most cars are simply not being allowed back into the region. I believe, as folks, as recently as yesterday, there was one highway into Asheville. But, of course, people in the mountains, and nobody can ride on some of these roads. Anyway, she hopes people will pitch in wherever you are. The portrait of Helene emerging is that of historic disaster, requiring historic levels of collective action and generosity. So, there are many organizations to donate to. You can go to, now many of these places, I'll tell you, will have computer links. If you can, fortunate enough to do those, you can get to phone numbers that way. I can't read everything on this long list. But you can find a list that has been vetted for security from Blue Ridge Public Radios. Blue Ridge Public Radio, as well as local ways to contribute to relief in Western North Carolina. Here are a few of these local resources. And the list, it says, will be updated in this publication, IndyWeek.com. We'll have this article. GoFundMe, Hurricane Helene Hub. Appalachian Voices gives you a list of shelters, drop-off sites, and organizations. The Assembly, that's a guide to apply for federal and state assistance. And WNC Resource Guide goes county by county. Now, drop-off sites for supplies, which, again, we take special attention as to what supplies actually are the most in need. Diaper Bank of North Carolina, they have a list of drop-off locations. There's an Amazon wish list and donations from the Diaper Bank. Back Alley Bikes in Carrboro, they are, let's see, Burial, B-U-R-I-A-L, Beer Company in Raleigh, collecting items for Triangle YP Civitan. Dogwood Country Club, Crabtree Boulevard, collecting items for Operation Airdrop. Raleigh, United Mutual Aid Hub, R-U-M-A-H, that's on Hillsborough Street, drop-off during events. There's a calendar on their website, Raleigh United Mutual Aid Hub. Bond Brothers Beer Company over in Cary, collecting for the Civitan. Raleigh Brewing on Neal Street in Raleigh, collecting items for Operation Airdrop. Art Post in Iredell, 718 Iredell in Durham. They're open 12 to 6 p.m. Monday through Saturday. Bull City Smiles on North Duke Street in Durham, Monday through Thursday, 8 to 5. Full Stream and Boxyard RTP. Their offices, they are collecting items. Most of these are collection points now for Triangle Civitan. Fuzzy Needle, Chapel Hill Street in Durham, is collecting. Glass Jug, Foster Street in Suite 10. I guess that's Durham. Collecting items for Civitan. Maverick Smokehouse and Taproom, West Main Street in Durham, open normal business hours. Scrap Exchange, Chapel Hill Road in Durham, open Tuesday through Sunday. And now, Volunteer Operations, Triangle Mutual Aid. There is a volunteer form online, again, Triangle Mutual Aid. They sort and organize donations. Diaper Bank, you've already heard about. The Blood Center, information about donating blood. And then, Animal Care. Forsyth, Humane Society is rescuing animals and coordinating emergency foster care. That network extends all the way to Durham. Rescuing Animals is a link in this article from Forsyth Humane Society, and Emergency Foster Care is another link. So go to Forsyth Humane Society. And finally, there's a large list of animal rescue organizations available who are looking for donations and foster care homes. All right, folks, that's that. I just apologize. I can't communicate all the links and things. They're not printed in the paper. You have to find them online or get somebody to help you with that. And, of course, there's always money. Money is a chief need in the very late, early stages, and there are many reputable organizations that will take our dollars. And let's cough it up for these folks out there. All right, that concludes that article, and I'll catch my breath and start again in a couple of seconds. I can guarantee that the Indy Week, the Independent, and almost every other journal of any description will be election-heavy in the upcoming weeks, and today is no exception to that. First article, in close election, contention and confusion on the Triangle campuses over voter ID. Chapel Hill, UNC, has been at the center of a controversy over student voting excess. Earlier this month, the state Republican Party and National Committee filed a suit against the Board of Elections in North Carolina for approving UNC's digital student ID for voting. Now, there's an update already. This story, the State Court of Appeals has ruled in favor of that Republican Party suit. That ruling means UNC, Chapel Hill students, and employees are barred, cannot use digital IDs at the polls. You have to have a regular card of some sort. Just a few miles away at Duke University, students face a different set of obstacles. Administrators are scrambling because the school's digital ID, which is routinely used by most students, was rejected by the board in late August. Student votes are a contentious issue in battleground North Carolina, where Kamala Harris and Donald Trump are running. At Duke, many students are eager to vote, but are confused by the logistics. At the heart of that confusion, the question of student IDs. A voting rights volunteer in Durham said, for a Duke student, you practically need a Venn diagram to know what to do in order to vote. Duke transitioned to these fully digital IDs in 2023 and stopped routinely issuing physical ID cards to students. Then the administrators learned on August the 21st that the electronic ID will not be accepted at the polls, and they're now rushing to provide physical IDs to its undergraduates. But questions around IDs persist. The danger is there's confusion about the IDs they need, says a history professor. If it's not made easily available, it's going to make it harder for people to vote. A long-time voting pattern underlies this conflict in North Carolina. Young voters tend to vote Democratic. Voters age 18 to 24 make up 11% of the state's electorate, according to registration data. But in the March primary, dozens of Duke student votes were tossed out because the students lacked proper ID. This November marks the first general election where they are required to bring valid photo ID to the polls, a result of a law passed by the Republican-controlled General Assembly. Student IDs are not the only acceptable form of identification. Valid passports, North Carolina driver's licenses also accepted. Students can also use driver's license and other government-issued IDs from other states, but only if they register within 90 days of the election. Well, we're in that period now. It feels like it's just so convoluted, in my opinion, says the students. It's another form of voter suppression. That's what all these laws are designed to do. Many students mistakenly believe their electronic Duke IDs, that's the one they rely on for everything, from food to dorm access, will work at the polls. On June 14, Duke applied to the Board of Elections seeking approval of electronic student ID, and on August, the council replied by email saying it does not appear that the Duke ID complies with the law. For the future, it may be helpful to reference the UNC Chapel Hill application. because the Duke digital cards don't have expiration dates, and students do not have to upload governmental IDs to verify their identities to state requirements for student IDs, which are used at the voting booth. Assistant Director of Duke State Relations said she was not entirely surprised when Duke's digital application was not accepted. Quote, we were hoping that maybe it would meet the requirements, but because there had not been any mobile cards approved, there wasn't really any specific guidance. In an attempt to provide students with physical IDs, the university started with incoming freshmen printing these cards that can be used for voting purposes and distributing them on move-in day. Still, thousands of Duke students did not receive physical IDs when they arrived on campus. Some 1,700 sophomores and nearly 10,000 Duke graduate and professional students have not received physical IDs that can be used in the voting booth. Now the university is hurrying to make physical ID cards available for sophomores. Debbie DiLulia, director of Duke Card Operations, said, Duke Card has pre-printed physical IDs for all sophomores, and Student Affairs will send students pickup information this week. Graduate and professional students must still make appointments with the office to request these IDs. Many students remain unsure of what IDs they need to vote. A senior said, so far there hasn't been a lot of communication on what's required. I have to just say, you don't read the news. I guess we don't. David Zhao, a master's degree student in computer science, said he never received a physical ID card and only knows about the voter ID laws from online advertisements. I'm definitely confused, said another senior. Peck, of course, worries this confusion will affect the ability to vote. This is the real risk. Most students think their IDs are in their phones. Peck knows from past experience that confusion over IDs can lead to tossed ballots. That election in March of 2024 primary was the first statewide election where the voter laws were in practice. Of the 288 students who voted, one in every eight had their ballots thrown out, nearly double the average of Durham counties. The most common reason? Invalid IDs. Especially in a swing state, every vote counts. In 2020, of more than 5 million ballots cast, the state Supreme Court Chief Justice race was decided by 401 votes. Duke administrators say they're working to keep students informed about ID laws. That's our number one priority. We're planning some pretty widespread communications to students, social media posts, inclusion in newsletter, Duke Today stories. Chloe Decker, who is the chair of Duke Votes, a student-led organization, is actively working to reach students, particularly sophomores. I follow the Duke Votes Instagram, so that's pretty much where I've gotten all my information from, said a sophomore. Duke Votes sets up a table on Duke's Bryan Center Plaza multiple days a week, helping students register to vote and request these cards. Duke sophomore Kemi Diver registered to vote at a votes table recently. It was really helpful to get my card, she said. I can just use my card and it'll make voting so easy. Duke Card's office said the office will consider requiring students to upload government IDs in future years to comply with the statutory requirements. But I honestly don't know how students would feel about that, DiLulia said. We've already struggled a little bit to get everyone to upload their photo before they come. This fall, the surest way for students to sort out mishaps before deadline is to register to vote ahead of the registration deadline. That's October the 11th, coming right up, ahead of the deadline, and vote early. During early voting, students can fix problems with their registrations. And if they show up with the wrong ID, there is still time to cast a ballot. And early voting opens October 17 at Karsh Alumni and Visitor Center and other sites around Durham. And it ends on November 2nd. All right, let's go continue with the election. Well, beyond the candidate's election, our bond issue. Wake County has a library bond on voters' ballots this fall. How would the money be spent? The town of Wendell has outgrown its tiny community library. It's easy to see why, even before you've stepped inside. The town is buzzing, stretching, bursting with new development. Blocks of townhomes in various stages of construction line the roads, punctuated by backhoes and clear-cut lots ripe for something new. The once sleepy suburb added 5,000 new residents between 2020 and 23, bringing its population to 14,000 votes. By 2030, town officials expect that number to double. The library hasn't quite kept up. Its single rectangular room is divided into a children's area on one side and adult section on the other. Handmade paper cutouts of trees adorn the walls, and colorful book displays announce the arrival of autumn and Hispanic Heritage Month. There are a handful of public computers in the back corner, and a friendly librarian sits behind the front desk. It's a picture of small town coziness, but like Wendell, it's bursting at the seams. This November, the very last question on the Wake County ballot will ask voters if they support a $142 million bond to improve the public library system, the county library system. The bond would pay for a new, bigger library in Wendell, as well as two new libraries in Apex and Rollsville. Of the replacement of the Athens Drive Community Library in Raleigh, the expansion of Fuquay-Varina Community Library into a regional, and much-needed renovations to several other libraries within the system. The last time Wake County passed a library bond was in 2007, where voters agreed to direct $45 million to library renovations and replacements. In the intervening 17 years, the county has exploded with newcomers, and its nationally acclaimed library system has aged. Katrina Vernon, Assistant Director of Wake County Public, we have over a million residents. That's a lot of people we're trying to offer library service to. Something that's really core to our mission is making sure we're building, maintaining, and growing our system in an equitable way. Because Wake County is so large and population relatively decentralized, the library system looks a bit different from those in other counties. There is no main downtown library. Instead, Wake has 8 large regional libraries and 14 smaller community libraries. Even with this decentralized system, there are still many people who don't live near a library. One of Wake's main goals with the bond is to increase the number of residents who can drive to a library in under 10 minutes. The addition of these new ones in Apex and Rollsville would put 87% of the population within that radius. That's up from 84.7%. The bond also contains about $43 million to renovate existing libraries, including new carpets, furniture, roofs, HVAC, and security systems. Vernon says, of course, we want to grow our library system, but we also want to make sure our existing facilities are kept accessible, safe, and beautiful, and are places that people want to come and use. So, question answer. How would the $142 million be spent? Okay, again, the list. New libraries, a community library in Rollsville, and in the Friendship area of Apex. Replacing Athens Drive Community Library, replacement of Wendell, and a new to be determined facility, which will promote digital equity. Renovations to 8 existing locations: the Express Library on Fayetteville Street, downtown Raleigh, Green Road Community Library, Leesville Community, the Northeast Regional Library, Richard Harrison Community Library, Southeast Regional, Zebulon Community, and the Library Administration Building. These all get renovations. And three, Fuquay-Varina Community Library turns into a regional. Vernon and her colleagues have spent the past 2 years assessing the system's needs and choosing which projects to prioritize. They identified underserved areas and calculated which libraries have gone the longest without renovations, large-scale renovations. They also decided to replace Wendell and Athens Drive because the former is too small and the latter is located inside a high school, which county officials decided is suboptimal for students and patrons alike. Feedback from community members and the Board of Commissioners shaped this bond proposal, which includes money for a, quote, new facility dedicated to digital equity. Tony Kenyon, a member of the all-volunteer library commission, says the plans for this facility are still in flux. It won't necessarily be a traditional library, but whatever forms it takes, it will be designed to support underserved communities. The system's regular budget does not contain money for these types of projects. It only covers everyday operating costs like buying books, paying staff. To majorly expand and renovate the system, the county needs to raise extra money. Vernon says the most efficient way for us to fund that is through a bond, so we have to make sure that Wake County voters are in agreement with this because there is a tax impact. If this measure passes, the bond would cost taxpayers $2.50 for every $100,000 of assessed property value per year. That means a homeowner whose house is worth now $470,000, that's the median property value for Wake County in April, that means that value would pay an extra $12 a year. Work would begin in fiscal 2026 and staggered over several years. As Wake County grows, Vernon says libraries are more critical than ever. Libraries, she says, are the last place you can go and be there all day and not have to spend any money and not be asked why you're there. We see people who are unhoused, who need a place to stay that is warm or cool, and they'll be in our facilities all day. We also see people who work from home, and they come in and work from our facilities all day. We want all the people to come and use the libraries for whatever reason they have. We really do not place judgment on how they use our libraries. In preparation for the referendum, Vernon and her colleagues asked the public how they use the library and what they want to see in the future. They want the ability to treat the library like their living room. They want to be comfortable there. Some people come from books. Others need access to technology and free Wi-Fi. The library has resources for seniors, job seekers, students, and researchers. Lisa Mead, who chairs the Library Commission, it's not just a place to borrow books anymore. There's so much additional programming going on. Lynn Edmonds, a school board member who also serves on the commission, investing in libraries is one way to safeguard against censorship and book bans. As someone that believes in the freedom to read and is opposed to banning books, if people really want to honor the freedom to read, there is no better way to advocate for that than to support this library bond. Rollsville is the only municipality in the county that doesn't have its own library. Town officials are eager to see that change with the passage of this bond. Mayor Ronnie Curran says the town has been asking for a library for 17 years. His predecessor, Frank Eagles, advocated it throughout his 12-year term. Curran has been working on the project since he was elected in 2019, and in that time, the town has grown exponentially, and it no longer makes sense for residents to schlep through traffic to visit Wake Forest or Zebulon. At this point, says Curran, we need our own, just like we need our own grocery stores. The Indy met Curran, Kenyon, and Rollsville communications specialist Candace Scarberry at Rollsville Town Hall to discuss the bond. All three expressed excitement about the bond and remarked on the relatively small tax impact. Kenyon remarks, let's say you own a $465,000 home, you're looking at around $11.50 tax increase. Curran replies, you can't go to McDonald's for $11.50. Scarberry, 29, grew up in Rollsville, a low-income household without internet access. She remembers making frequent trips to Wake Forest to visit the library where she'd pick out books and use the free Wi-Fi. For families like hers, Scarberry says having a library in town offers so much potential that people don't even realize is there. They've been so accustomed to just dealing with it. Making their lives that much easier is so important. All right, more election. And we've been following some of this story for quite a few weeks now. The Wake County School Board elections are nonpartisan in name only. Officially, the board is a nonpartisan body. In practice, its 9 elected members often vote along partisan lines. 7 Democrats consistently support measures advancing equity and non-discrimination in schools, and the 2 Republicans regularly try to block those measures. This November, 5 seats on the school board are up for election, including 4 that Democrats occupy currently. Wake County Republican Party has seized an opportunity to gain a stronger foothold on that board and mounted a slate of candidates who, in many cases, espouse book bans and, quote, parents' rights, and align themselves with Michelle Morrow, the far-right candidate for state superintendent of public instruction and former Wake County School Board candidate who promotes conspiracy theories and political violence. Every school board race but one features a Wake Democrat and North Carolina Association of Educators, NCAE, endorsed candidate running against a Wake Republicans and Carolina Teachers Alliance, CTA, endorsed opponent. The NCAE is the state public school employees union. The CTA bills itself as the conservative alternative to the NCAE, quote, our teachers need to have the freedom to teach patriotism and love of country and should not be forced to deliver biased political indoctrination, states the CTA website. The candidates generally agree on the basics. North Carolina should pay teachers more, help students rebound from pandemic-era learning loss, and improve school safety. Points of disagreement include federal Title IX protections, diversity, equity, and inclusion, and the Parents' Bill of Rights, a controversial piece of legislation that critics say discriminates against LGBTQ students and makes it harder for teachers to do their jobs. Adding to the stakes of this election, the next school board may get the chance to appoint a new member to replace District 4 Representative Monica Johnson Hostler, who is running for NC House District 33. Johnston Hostler is one of the board's liberal members and is favored to win her statewide race. Well, here's who is running for school board this year and where they stand on the issues. And this, the rest of this article runs 2 more pages. In District 3, the incumbent, Wing Nying, a Republican, is facing a challenge from Jordine Blaise. Wing is a physician who was first elected in 2022. His campaign website advocates for curriculum transparency, parental engagement, and school safety, among other topics, but the mild language belies more extreme views. In July, Wing voted against bringing the school system into compliance with the Department of Education's updated Title IX policy. That policy prohibits sex-based discrimination in schools because it expands protection for LGBTQ students. wing criticized language in the policy that protects students' rights to participate in a program or activity consistent with their gender identity, and said he's opposed allowing trans students to play women's sports at school. By the way, his family name is NG, and I'm told that's Wing. Wien also tried to block Wake schools from applying from a We Need Diverse Books grant, arguing it could violate the Parents' Bill of Rights. Wake County Republican Party and the conservative Carolina Teachers Alliance both have endorsed Wien. Last election cycle, the local chapter of Moms for Liberty, which promotes parents' rights and banning books that discuss gender identity from schools and opposes Title IX protections for LGBTQ students, endorsed Wing as well. Wing has campaigned with Mark Robinson and Michelle Morrow and donated to Robinson's campaign. Jordine Blaze, Wing's opponent, is a leadership consultant with a background in education and law. She worked as an English teacher in Florida before attending Georgetown Law and working as legislative counsel to Washington, D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser. Blaze moved from D.C. to Raleigh to work for NC State University as a deputy Title IX coordinator and equity compliance officer, then launched her consulting business. She lists educational equity, competitive teacher staff pay, efficient budgeting, and inclusivity as her top priorities on her campaign website. The Wake Democrats and the Wake chapter of NCAE have both endorsed her. District 3 has the potential to be a tight race, considering its mix of urban and rural voters, spanning from North Raleigh up through Wake Forest to the top of Wake County. Per Ballotpedia, just a handful of percentage points decided the past two competitive elections in 2018 and 2022. That's District 3. What about District 4? Incumbent Toshiba Rice was appointed to the District 4 seat by her school board colleagues in February after her predecessor, Tara Waters, left to join the Wake County Board of Commissioners. Rice is CEO of a wellness consulting firm in Raleigh and executive director of Track My Steps, a statewide education nonprofit dedicated to closing economic and racial achievement gaps. In her short stint on the school board, she's voted in favor of the Title IX updates and against renewing the school system's contract with its school resource officers, citing their unequal treatment of black and brown students. She received endorsements from the Democrats and the NCAE. The Republican-endorsed candidate, Roberto Morales Vergara, dropped out of the race in August and endorsed Rice. That leaves two other challengers, Sean Callan and Michael Williams. Neither has a campaign website or robust online presence. Callan is a research and policy associate with the North Carolina Administrative Office of the Courts. Williams is an education consultant and former teacher and guidance counselor who ran for the seat in 2022 and has the conservative CTA endorsement. District 4 spans from southeast Raleigh over to Knightdale. District 5, incumbent Lynn Edmonds running against Ted Hills. Edmonds, endorsed by Democrats and NCAE, took office in 22. Her involvement with the system dates back to 2002 as a PTA volunteer while her two children were enrolled in Wake Public Schools. Edmonds eventually became a PTA president, served on the Board Advisory Council for Districts 4 and 5, and founded Great Schools in Wake, a public education advocacy organization. In her 2 years on the school board, Edmonds has supported Title IX and advocated for the General Assembly to fully fund the Leandro Plan, a plan to direct more state dollars to public education to meet students' basic educational needs. Ted Hills, her opponent, an IT professional and the Wake Republican's choice for District 5. According to reporting from the News and Observer, Hills decided to join the race after receiving an email from Michelle Morrow saying there was no conservative candidate challenging Edmonds. In August, he told the gathering of members of the Western Wake Republican Club he's running to oppose the current federal Title IX rules, which protects gender identity. His campaign website says the school board has focused on everything but academics this term, which has to change. District 5 covers West Raleigh and Holly Springs. Edmonds won by a wide margin in 22. District 6 covers Northern Raleigh. Incumbent Sam Hershey faces a challenge from Josh Points. Before he was elected in 22, Hershey spent 19 years volunteering and working in the Wake County Public School System as an athletic coach, PTA member, and board advisory council representative for Douglas Elementary, where his son is enrolled. Since joining the school board, Hershey has supported Title IX, secured funding for renovations to several District 6 schools, and advocated for pay raises for teachers, staff, and crossing guards, according to his website. The Wake Democrats and the NCAA have both endorsed him. Points, the Wake Republicans and CTA-endorsed challenger is a commercial real estate broker based in Raleigh. On his website, he says he wants to improve student outcomes, reform special education, and, quote, reduce educational bureaucracy. He also alludes to the Moms for Liberty championed parents' rights movement and suggests linking teacher pay raises to student proficiency. Finally, District 8. Four-term Representative Lindsay McAfee is campaigning for re-election against Elizabeth McDuffie, the favored candidate of GOP and the CTA. That district covers parts of Apex, Holly Springs, and Fuquay Varina. McAfee, a former teacher whose three children attend Wake County Public Schools and is running on her personal experience as an educator and parent, and on her record of adding eight new schools in her district, raising minimum staff pay across the system, and restoring master's degree pay raises during her school board tenure. She's endorsed by the Wake Democrats and the NCAA and received Moms Demand Action's Gun Sense Candidate Distinction for her commitment to gun violence prevention. McDuffie is a realtor and former teacher with 20 years of classroom experience, including 10 in Wake County Public Schools. According to her campaign site, she wants to raise salaries, address learning loss, and generally support students' academic success. Unlike some of the other GOP-endorsed candidates, her online presence contains no mention of parents' rights or gender ideology. Still, McDuffie has participated in the County Republican Party's campaign events alongside the other GOP school board candidates and hard-right statewide candidates, including Michelle Morrow. All right, on to non-governmental, specifically governmental articles. First, the Regulator Bookstore endures. As you enter Regulator, your eyes may be drawn to the mural in the children's section featuring an air balloon and a camel, both carrying books. Or you may notice the new section at the entrance, a popular section curated by the owners and employees from new books they've enjoyed to the most discussed novels. The space is small and may not have every book you want. It's no two-floor Barnes & Noble, and there's no dedicated romance section in sight. In a world of digital consumption, brick-and-mortar bookstores are often seen as antiques of a nostalgic era. Yet, the Regulator remains a cherished community staple. Former Duke professor Laurent Dubois wrote in the book My Bookstore, "Part of what Durham is in so many ways is the intersection between Duke University and the broader community, and the bookstore is pivotal in that relationship." But is that pivotal role enough to guarantee its survival? 50 years ago, Duke alum David Burkhead founded the Regulator Press, printing political news for grassroots organizations. 2 years later, in 1976, fellow Duke alumni Tom Campbell and Aidan Field joined, and the trio began selling books, and the Regulator Bookshop was born. bearing the name of a group of North Carolinians who spearheaded a revolt against the British in the 1760s, the regulator embraces nonconformity and progressive values. It has served as a hub for the exchange of ideas, welcoming outspoken authors like Margaret Atwood, John Hope Franklin, and former Vice President Al Gore. In 1978, following Field's departure, John Valentine, another Blue Devil, joined Campbell until both retired in 2017 and sold the store to two longtime employees, Wander Lorenz de Haas and Elliot Berger. Campbell and Valentine wanted the bookstore to carry on the culture they forged, championing small presses and catering to the diverse tastes of its community. Now, the regulator stands as one of the oldest establishments on a street transformed. The regulator persists even as other bookstores struggle. Durham's Letters Bookshop recently announced they are shifting from private ownership to community-owned cooperative for long-term survival. On a recent Sunday, the soft hum of conversation mingles with the occasional rustle of pages and music curated by the staff. The tinkling of the doorbell signals the arrival of a young family whose two children eagerly dart between the bookshelves, heading for the book nook, two warm couches where other children and adults are reading. Mika Murphy, 27, a longtime employee, says, "It's hard to describe how much the bookshop owes to the community. Local elementary and middle schools hold scavenger hunts that lead them to the bookstore, and book clubs shop for their books at the store. Everyone from your teacher or your garbage collector, public service worker, to our state senators and city council people come through," says Murphy. "It's like a meeting place for people of all walks of life in Durham." As bookstores nationwide grapple with the challenges posed by the rise of e-books and online retailers, it's easy to wonder if they are the next Blockbuster, the multimedia rental chain that ceased operations in 2014. Bookstore sales plummeted by 45% from 2007 to 2019, falling from $16.8 billion to $9.12 billion. Meanwhile, the number of U.S. bookstores dropped from over 12,000 to about 6,000 between 1998 and 2019. Brick and mortar bookstores' biggest competitor, of course, Amazon. Within 5 years of Amazon's inception in 1995, the number of independent bookstores declined by 43%. Now Amazon controls over 50% of the print book market and 80% of the e-book market. Lawrence de Haas, one of the shop's owners, says Amazon is a concern, although our focus is on books they rarely promote and do not surface easily with their algorithms. And Durham community member Jonathan Corbin agrees. Who wants to give up the experience of going to your bookstore? The calm, safe environments, the smell of books, the friendly people, the opportunity to run across books you could love that isn't dictated by some algorithm that boxes you in. Need I say more? He wrote in his Google review of the regulator. The store has had to make some changes to survive. The bookstore closed amidst the pandemic and discontinued in-store events after it was reopened. The new owners no longer lease the downstairs area, which previously housed the events, used books, or a cafe. It's also made some additions. It hosts an online store where customers can place orders for pickup or delivery. It also has presences on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Yet the store's in-person sales, aided by its prime location, continue to be its primary source of revenue. As a New York Times reported bookstore, what the regulator sells is reported to the Times bestseller lists. The store has been profitable for 7 years now, according to its owners. In fall or other busy times of the year, the store might seem between 100 and 200 faces a day, many of them regulars. Lawrence DeHaas says, I am very bullish on the future of the shop. We have made it into a very distinctive shop. Until the day an Amazon bookstore opens next to them, he's not worried. All right, with 8 minutes to go, let's do a book review. There is a book review. Well, it is a book review, but it's more about an interview with Anne Byrne, B-Y-R-N, at the Durham Hotel, which will be take place on Monday, October 14th at 6 p.m. Anne Byrne, the cookbook author who gained national prominence in the early 2000s for teaching people how to gussy up boxes of Betty Crocker with add-ins like sour cream and sherry, still embraces her cake mix doctor moniker. But Byrne's most recent cookbooks have seen her take less of an advisory role and more of a narrative, archival one. Out this month, her latest books, Baking in the American South, 200 Recipes and Their Untold Stories, only includes three of her own family's recipes. The rest are sourced from department stores, school cafeterias, mills, and churches across the South, drawn from people like Country Ham King Alan Benton and the 1930s-era boarding house owner Ma Hoyle. A Nashville native and a fifth-generation Tennessean who spent years as a food editor at the Atlanta Journal and the Tennessean, Byrne brings a sense of both familiarity and curiosity to the rigorously researched, effortlessly written Baking in the American South, which features recipes from her home state plus 13 others. If you bake a vast, deep-dish fruit pie in most places in the South, you've made a cobbler, writes Byrne. But in Surrey and Wilkes counties in North Carolina, that same dish is called a sonker, S-O-N-K-E-R. Sonker was the invention of Scottish and Scots-Irish immigrants who began settling in the Yadkin Valley of North Carolina in the early 1700s, and that word traces to the Gaelic songl, or sonkle, meaning little mess. Ahead of this October 14th event at the Durham Hotel, Indy chatted with Byrne about the research that went into baking in the American South, the future of hyper-regional recipes, and the most iconic baked goods to come out of North Carolina. So this is a Q&A. While you were working on the book, how much were you on the road versus doing research and calling on sources from your career? It was about 50-50, she replied. It started as a project that might have been more on the road, but I think because of COVID, the research came first. It was the matter of educating myself about, or trying to figure out, what was the southern region. If I wanted to include these states, how did I learn about them? Who did I contact in that state? And then, who did I talk to for really broad cultural topics? I wanted to learn about railroads and slavery and rice cultivations and all those topics that had come up. It feels like a work of journalism as well as a functional cookbook. It was like walking on railroad ties, straddling back and forth between the two. Why did you decide to take this sort of reported approach? It's just the way I've always been. I've always been curious. I've always asked a lot of questions. I'm a newspaper journalist. I come to cookbooks via newspapers, so I've never left that interest in digging out answers and finding people that nobody's ever heard of, because that would be the type of stories that I would want to report on if there were still newspapers like there used to be. I'm not a historian, but I am a curious person, and I always have loved the South, and I always loved to bake, and I brought that real keen interest, and I have the time to dedicate to find people. I found out about a fabulous resource right here in Nashville. The Vanderbilt Medical School has one of the largest cookbook collections in the nation. There's just so many resources. With Ancestry.com, Newspapers.com, anybody could dig into the story if they wanted to. If you didn't believe the first 25 pop-ups from your Google search, set those aside and then go really look. Something that stood out to me question is in the introduction to the book, was you saying that recipes in the South became hyper-regional because their people were, but also that recipes transcended state lines. You wrote, a small town in southern Kentucky was a hub connecting rail lines north and south, allowing imported bananas to travel from docks in New Orleans and Mobile clear up to New York and Philadelphia, which might explain why there are so many banana pudding recipes in Kentucky cookbooks. Do you have any thoughts about whether we can still be hyper-regional in that way? If there are still siloed communities that are coming up with hyper-regional recipes? That's a real powerhouse of a question. There are some quirky ones like Lane cake and the sticky lemon cheesecake that are real deep, deep South. I had never heard of those when I grew up in Tennessee. Those recipes stuck in certain communities in part because they were a lot of trouble. They were written about in local cookbooks, but probably because their expense and the time it took to make them, they just didn't go anywhere. These are also the types of recipes I have some fear about dying out. The Lane cake and the smell of the whiskey on the counter that goes into that cake is mentioned in To Kill a Mockingbird, but it's only just sort of referred to. The Lane cake is also Jimmy Carter's favorite cake. He's about to turn 100, so anyone in their 30s may not really care that that was Jimmy Carter's favorite cake. Whereas something like banana pudding, you mentioned, crosses racial lines, economic lines, and state lines because it's affordable, because people who lived near the docks in coastal cities like Mobile and New Orleans had access to bananas that fell off of the bunches that didn't get loaded onto the train. I think a lot of it has to do with access and availability and being able to cross lines. I know that's a mishmash of an answer. It was a mishmash of a question. It's a good one to ponder for sure. Well, another thing to ponder for sure is that there's two more pages to this wonderful review. And again, a promo for An Evening with Anne Byrne, Monday, October 14th, 6 p.m. at the Durham Hotel. I'm imagining that that event at the Durham Hotel is would be admission. But I'm not sure. I can't say for sure. However, I am sure that our broadcast is ending in 45 seconds, time enough for me to tell you that John Feddersen has enjoyed reading to you today, and there will be a substitute, I believe, in a couple of weeks anyway, and that we will be back, and that this whole issue, as read by me, was on the ncreadingservice.org, ncreadingservice.org, our website, and that that's where you can access it if you need to hear any more, particularly about the list of those places to donate to Hurricane Helene relief. So thanks, everybody, for listening. John Feddersen for the ncreadingservice.org. Bye-bye.